Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everyone. I think I may have the solution to America's problems. We've always been looking for issues that the left and the right agree on, and certainly the left is feeling stronger and stronger about housing in the United States. A few days ago, we had my old friend Dale Maharidge on the show, very distinguished journalist, professor, man of the left. He has a new book out, American Doom Loop. And he writes, he had an interesting LA Times op-ed about the growth of homelessness and the problem of a liberal coastal elite that doesn't want any development, doesn't want any new building, and there simply aren't enough homes for Americans. We also had a show a few days ago with Alexander Gorlin and Victoria Newhouse, both, I think, figures of traditional liberal Manhattan. Newhouse is a liberal aristocrat, Alexander Gorlin, a distinguished architect. They have a new book out, Housing the Nation, in which they too argue for building more homes in America, especially for America's homeless and also for its, shall we say, underhoused. They're both, all these figures, Gorlin, Newhouse, Maharidge, they're all on the political left. And now we have a new book out, a particularly interesting book. It's called Build, Baby Build, The Science and Ethics of Housing Regulation, written or co-authored by Brian Kaplan, who's coming on the show. Brian is a professor of economics at George Mason University. I'm not sure if I would describe him as a conservative, certainly as a libertarian. And like Maharidge and Gorlin and Newhouse, Kaplan is a supporter of building more homes for Americans. Brian is joining us. Brian, is this something that can unite left and right in America? Finally, the recognition that we need to borrow the title of your book, Build, Baby, Build?
It can unite reasonable people of a wide range of political views. It's unfortunate that most people are just so attached to politics as religion. But the main case that I make in the book is that there's so much good about allowing people to build that almost any philosophy should endorse it. And you can just pick and choose among the benefits and say, those are the benefits that change my mind. But yeah, like if people were reasonable about it, then I think we could really get a bipartisan consensus here.
And I don't mean to pigeonhole you, Brian, but would it be fair to describe you as a libertarian? George Mason University is one of the intellectual hotbeds of, I don't know whether you want to call it conservative libertarianism. The book is brought out by the Cato Institute. How would you define your politics, or are they indefinable?
Definitely the libertarian label is accurate. I've got no problem with it. But when I write a book, I'm not trying to preach to the choir. I'm trying to talk to anybody that wants to listen. I'm not here to say we start with from the same premises as me and we end up with the same conclusion. That's easy. What I really want to say is let's start with really mild premises, something that almost anyone should be able to agree with. Like if you build more houses, the price will go down. If you build a lot more houses, the price will go down a lot. That's the kind of thing that I want to work with.
Well, that's why we got you on the show, Brian. There seems to be a consensus that there's an enormous problem in America with housing and homelessness. We've done many shows. One show we did last year was Kevin Adler, When We Walk By, Forgotten Humanity, Broken Systems, and the role we can each play in ending homelessness in America. He's more interested in homelessness in a humanitarian or humanistic sense rather than in terms of policy. How deep a problem, Brian, in your view, is this question of homelessness? We were talking before we went live. You were a grad student at Berkeley.
I was.
In the East
Bay. Actually, an undergraduate at Berkeley.
So you're all too familiar with homelessness in the Bay Area. It's similar in Los Angeles and in New York. How deep a problem, in your view, is it in America?
it's really important to distinguish between different kinds of homelessness. Usually when you see statistics, they're just counting you as homeless if you don't have any permanent residence. So if you're sleeping on your brother's couch, you get counted as homeless in regular statistics. Or if you're just couch surfing, that would count as well. What I'd say is that for this broadly defined kind of homelessness, where anyone who doesn't have a permanent address counts as homeless, then housing regulation is crucial, because that kind of homelessness does heavily depend upon the price of housing. If it gets cheap enough, then you'll get off your brother's couch and get your own place. The best work on this, there's a book called Homelessness is a Housing Problem, and it does go through lots of different predictors. What are the best predictors of homelessness? And their answer is simply that the absolute rental price of a place is the best predictor. It's basically just really hard to be so desperate and so destitute that you can't make rent in rural Mississippi. Whereas making rent in the downtown San Francisco is really hard. For what people probably think of more as homelessness, which is people sleeping on the streets, that's where I'm less optimistic. And it doesn't mean that reducing the price wouldn't help somewhat, but if you really are at the point where you're spending every penny that you've got on opioids, then yeah, just making homelessness or making housing cheaper isn't going to help you much. But the main thing is we can just make a really big dent in this problem by making housing cheaper. And that is one of the main points of the book for a long list of problems. That's why I call housing deregulation the panacea policy.
You've even got an image of...
Yes, panacea, the Greek goddess of universal remedy.
I want to get to the book in a minute, and certainly your very innovative way of presenting a graphic narrative. It's mm-hmm. really intriguing. But let's remind everyone, Brian, of the subtitle of the book, because I think that reveals not just your politics, but the mm-hmm. message, The Science and Ethics of Housing Regulation. Is the core of the problem, in your view, and this certainly is the problem in Berkeley because I lived there for many years, is the problem NIMBYism?
I'd say that's a good name for the general category, but it's pretty vague as to what NIMBYism actually is. Most people think of it as people just voting to keep their home prices as high as possible. I don't think that's really actually...
I'm sorry to interrupt. Let's just remind everyone, NIMBY means, of course, not in my backyard.
Right. Yeah, so I think when people hear that, they often do think of the selfish, cruel homeowner who is happy to go and immiserate the rest of the world just as long as they can keep their home prices high. That's a common view of it, but I just say the data doesn't really fit it. Why not? Well, for one thing, we've gone surveys when it turns out that tenants generally are also very NIMBY. The people that are renting who do not own, they don't have any home price to defend. In fact, when prices go up, they're the ones that suffer. They still are generally very opposed to allowing market rate housing to be built. And it's like, why? Well, if you're a tenant, why wouldn't you want as much housing as possible? And I say a lot of it's just economic illiteracy, just denial of this basic truism that if you produce a lot more housing, the price will go down. People just have a lot of trouble accepting this. It's like some kind of ideological thing. If there's a lot of housing, the price will go down. Often there's some sarcasm of, just because a lot of housing, why will that make people be nice and cut prices? And that's not the idea. It's not that having an abundance of housing makes people be nicer. The idea is that if there's abundance of housing, if you don't cut the price, you won't be able to sell it.
So let's get to the problem, Brian. So you've said you're less optimistic on dealing with homelessness because of the drug-related, maybe the mental health issues, dealing with it broadly defined.
Yeah, let's
leave that one. But so is the problem with the crisis that you're addressing, is it that there aren't enough homes, or that the homes are too expensive, or they're too small? Mm-hmm. What's the problem?
Yeah, well, those two things are almost the same thing. To say that there aren't enough homes, or to say they're too expensive. If we had a lot more homes, then they would be a lot less expensive. But the main reason why this is actually an insight is you say, the problem with steel is there should be more steel. It's like the main reason why there's something really interesting to say here is that we've actually got very hard data saying that the cost of producing these homes is just not that much. If you've got the pieces of paper from the government that allow you to do it. So really, a lot of the reason why you're seeing high prices is just that it's so hard to get all the documents, so hard to get all the permits, all the approvals. There's just so many ways that you can be delayed or prevented from building something. And I say this is a case of artificial scarcity. Sometimes the scarcity is built into nature. There's only so many front row seats at the basketball game to say, well, isn't it a shame that everybody can't sit in the front row? Well, if everyone is in the front row, it wouldn't be the front row anymore. On the other hand, for housing, it really is the case that there's just an enormous amount of extra production that's totally physically doable, totally technologically doable. It's not politically doable. Since you said you're in San Francisco, in the book, we actually do a helicopter tour of San Francisco, and you see the city is barely has any skyscrapers. We have the technology to go and massively increase the amount of housing in San Francisco. I mean, really, probably to the point of having 10 times as many units. But the problem is getting permission to build a skyscraper in San Francisco is like pulling teeth, or really by comparison.
Yeah, I mean, if you can fix local politics in San Francisco, Brian, then you can fix everything. So simply, let me just, and I apologize if I'm being a bit slow here. You mentioned earlier that the price of building a place in rural Mississippi in Manhattan is relatively similar. It's just a question of supply and demand. Where do you want the building to happen, in downtown San Francisco or Manhattan or in rural Mississippi, or doesn't it matter?
Well, I'd say I'd like it to happen wherever market forces say that there's actually demand for it. I mean, I would say that the actual restriction of housing supply in rural Mississippi is probably real low. Basically, a good rule is this: anywhere a lot of people live, government makes it hard to build stuff. It's not that hard to go and build stuff in the middle of nowhere. No one's complaining about it. You can probably just do what you want. But as soon as you get within, say, 50 miles of a major population center, that's where the rules become quite restrictive. It's really obvious when you look at a downtown where, like San Francisco, where the government is just withholding permission to build skyscrapers. But that is, you know, that is one of the important regulations. Another big one is just stopping multifamily dwelling. So, you know, like over 80% of residential land in the U.S. is just reserved for single family homes. If you want to put up an apartment building, normally it's just illegal or it's really hard to get permission.
So let's take the San Francisco example.
Yeah.
And there is, of course, I don't want to defend my local government because I think they're relatively indefensible, but there is the earthquake issue. I mean, you can't just build anything anywhere. But having said that,
I mean, that's not the reason they're not approving skyscrapers. Well, so, like, you build ones just as technologically sound as the ones that
I take your point. So what how is this playing itself out in San Francisco? The traditional narrative is that there aren't any policemen or teachers or librarians in San Francisco because they can't afford to live here. So they're living out in the suburbs and having to drive their cars, and you get further and further suburbs in the East Bay, worse and worse pollution and traffic. Is that the core problem here?
It's one of them. I mean, what I say is that, see, a lot of regulation is officially there to go and solve traffic and parking problems. But when you step back and think about it, it's like, yeah, well, like, a lot of the traffic you see is caused by some other place that wouldn't allow building where you are. Have you ever seen a sign saying, if you lived here, you'd be home by now? All right, it's a good point. It's like, well, then why can't I be home right now? Often it's because the local government there won't allow you to build. And their story may be, we don't want you causing traffic. It's like, well, but the reason we got traffic is there's other places that wouldn't let you build. One of the main things I say in the book is also that people are very happy to go and have strict regulation that makes housing really expensive. But if you say, how about we charge people a price to drive on the road during rush hour or to park when there's a lot of cars, and they lose their minds, say it makes a lot more sense to make housing cheap and then raise the price of driving and parking during peak times. And that means that, like, if you really want to go and drive or park during peak times, you pay extra for it. But otherwise, you can have cheap housing. You know, of course, a lot of people, when they face those incentives, will say, I want to live there and I won't have a car, but at least leaves it up to the individual person.
I'm guessing you're not a big fan of raising taxes or more intrusive local regulation, but what about the role of public transportation and the public sector indeed in doing this building?
Yeah, what I say is that In the United States, public transportation tends to be a giant money loser precisely because we don't have a lot of density. And also, we've got a bunch of other crazy regulations that make it really hard to build this stuff. So, like, by a lot of estimates in Europe, the cost of doing these projects is about 1/6 of what it is in the US. But
there's always the model for everything that's good about the world. So,
yeah. I mean, there's also regulations saying that it's hard to go and bring in a foreign contractor to go and build it. You've got to use local American companies to go and build it, even though they don't seem to be very good. Yeah, it would be better to go and bring in the Danes to go and run something like this. You know, I say is like there's nothing inherently good or bad about mass transit. It's just a question of, is it a good idea here under these conditions? And yeah, if you were able to go and build a lot more stuff at reasonable prices in downtowns, then mass transit would look like a much better deal. As to what the final story is, it's complicated. I'm not sure everyone would agree.
I'm a little hesitant to agree with you. There's nothing good or bad about mass transit, isn't it? By definition, if it's properly done, properly priced, properly built, a good thing. It addresses the environmental cost of driving, and it also results, I've seen this in New York in some ways, in more social integration of people of different classes and racial, cultural identities actually physically standing or sitting next to one another.
What I say is it all depends on, you make all those assumptions, it's got to be the right prices, the right this, well constructed, then sure. But the issue is we're in the real world. We're not in the world where we can settle our assumptions correctly. So that would be the main issue.
So do you have a city, a state that's at least beginning to do this, right? I was wondering, how would Houston or Dallas, for example, or Miami compare with San Francisco or New York?
Right. So all of those are better, definitely. Your phrasing was interesting, like places that are starting to do it right. I would say actually, especially Texas has been doing it right for a long time and may even be moving slowly in a more San Francisco direction. So it's worth it. There's a difference between moving in the right direction and just was good before. There are a bunch of states that you probably know. So California, Oregon, Minnesota, where they are deregulating a bit. Although they're deregulating from a super regulated level, so it's not going to be a model by any means. But Houston is a classic example. It's not as regulation-free as its fans would have you believe, but the regulation is light enough that its population just massively multiplied in the last couple of decades, whereas, of course, you haven't seen anything like that in San Francisco. I just like to think about it, we've got the technology. What we don't have is permission. Like, it's not something where we need to really figure anything out. Empire State Building was built in about a year, almost 100 years ago, right? We know how they did it. It's not hard to do. It's just hard to go and get all the permits that allow it. And what's the problem? Most of the problem is that we just take complaints way too seriously. Some of the complaints are true. It's like, build a skyscraper, block some light. But in the past, it's like, whatever. The project is way better than these problems, so we're just going to forge ahead.
Right. And what about the argument that the market works this stuff out? So, okay, San Francisco regulators are short-sighted enough not to allow anything. Rents go up. Everyone leaves and goes to Houston because that's where rents or homes are cheaper, or Miami. Hasn't that what happened? And in the end, San Francisco will have to wake up to its own reality and start building again. I mean, you're a free market guy. You're at the Cato Institute.
Right. Here's the important thing. Markets can go and make a bad situation less bad. That's what they do. However, it doesn't mean that it was fine to go and mess things up in the first place. It's a lot better if you can just go and build where you want to build rather than say, I guess I could go and move 1,000 miles away to another state. Like eventually things get bad enough, people leave. But that's not much of a defense of the status quo to say that it could be even worse. Yeah, we can imagine a world where no one could leave San Francisco, and then what would people be doing? You'd be living 10 to an apartment.
They already are in San Francisco.
All right, 25,
100. We're speaking with Brian Kaplan, the co-author of Build Baby Build, an incredibly innovative and entertaining, beautifully done new book, a work of graphic nonfiction, The Science and Ethics of Housing Regulation, and take a short break. And I want to come back and talk specifically about the book and those graphics, because Brian is not an artist. He had a partner. I want to talk to him about the attraction of doing this kind of book. I want to remind everyone that great guests like Brian Kaplan are brought to us through our friends at Liberties, an excellent new quarterly journal of culture and politics. Going to run a short feature on Liberties, and then we'll be back with Brian Kaplan to talk more about Build Baby Build. Don't go away, anyone. We're still going to be here in a couple of seconds.
The noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We're speaking with Brian Kaplan, an economics professor at George Mason University and the co-author of Build Baby Build. If you'd have just listened to the first half of our conversation, you'd assume that this might be just another rather dry libertarian argument against local regulation and in favor of building. But this book is more than just that. But Brian, explain what you're trying to do, putting out this this graphics book. Which is really interesting and intriguing, very different from the traditional kind of policy book.
Here's the problem. There's so much great research in the world that nobody reads because it's boring. What I spend a lot of time thinking about is, how can I get people to actually care about what we know? How can I show people that a particular study, which seems irrelevant in itself, is actually part of a bigger puzzle? And one of the things I've done, this is my second book of this kind, is to try to combine words and pictures to basically create a readable documentary. It's a readable documentary with an unlimited budget and with a time machine too, because you can show any image you want. It doesn't cost any more to draw a castle or a hovel. You can show any time period you want. In this book, there are a few pages where I have a time machine and I go back to before the Empire State Building was built. So, you know, this is really appeal. Why I got started on this, about 15 years ago, I started reading books of this kind. There's a series called The Cartoon History of the Universe by Larry Gonick. And when I was reading it, I was just so impressed because it's so much more entertaining than a regular history book. You can get a lot more information per minute by combining words and pictures, pictures worth 1,000 words. But also I realized this book is accurate. Any area of history that I know, the words are correct. So if, and then I said, could I do something like that? I do have this problem that I'm not an artist, but there is a division of labor. So I started storyboarding my first book like this. And then I was able to get a fantastic artist, Zach Wienersmith, to do my first book, Open Borders, of this kind. And then for this one, I couldn't get Zach, but I found another fantastic artist, Audie Bronze. And we decided we wanted to do it in the style of classic Disney. So Disney of the 1930s, like Snow White, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, like the beautiful illustrations from an earlier period. So I was very involved in every single image. I actually storyboarded it using Google Images, and I made notes to the artist. Then he would give me a draft, and I would just keep nudging him further and further until it looked just the way that I wanted it to look. My hope anyway is that I get a lot more people reading it because it's more entertaining. I get more, they spend more time on it. And also, I think that it's just more memorable. So I think that I can get more learning per minute.
Yeah, people are watching this. We have a few images from the book, which Brian generously lent us. It's a very entertaining book. As you said, this is the second book of its type. You wrote a book with Zach Wienersmith, Open Borders, The Science and Ethics of Immigration. Immigration is an even more controversial subject, of course, than housing, if that's possible.
No kidding.
How did you get away with that? Did you have a lot of hate, or did everyone accept that representing the moral issues around immigration, if it's done responsibly using graphic art, is actually a good thing?
I'd say that, so the book was a New York Times bestseller. A lot of people liked it, obviously. I mean, I've been arguing about immigration for, again, probably 15 years before the book came out. You are correct. There are a lot of people who are really angry about the issue. Part of what I'm trying to do with both of these books is to say, look, it's hard to have any kind of conversation with an angry person. If someone's upset, then they don't want to talk. They definitely don't want to listen. They want to talk. They don't want to listen. And what I said, look, what if I can get people to be amused? What if I can get them laughing? I think it's just easier to go and think about arguments when you are in a good mood. And that's what I'm trying to do. Like in both of these books, I don't want to sit there scolding people or saying, you're terrible. You need to go and change. I want to get them to think about it in an imaginative way, a creative way, show them a way of thinking about it that they haven't thought of before. And then talk to people like human beings. I know it's a radical idea, but I don't want to yell at people. I don't want to have people yell at me.
Whose opinion do we need? Because I don't think many people, Brian, are going to disagree with you about the need to rebuild American cities and provide affordable housing, new housing, high quality housing. Who do we need to convince? The subtitle of your book is The Science and Ethics of Housing Regulation. Is it addressed to housing regulators, to voters, to people who own their own homes? I mean, if you listen to guys like Dale Maharidge, the biggest problem is with liberal house owners who simply want to defend the price of their home.
Right. I mean, the latter accusation, I say we've got really good evidence that it's just wrong. It is true that liberal homeowners don't want to allow the building of more homes. Almost no one wants to allow the building of more market rate homes. I wish you were right that almost everybody agrees with this, but we've got good public opinion data. Building more market rate housing, just letting the free market build stuff, is one of the least popular solutions to this. A lot of what people want to do is just have the government subsidize it more, which is wait, you want to have more demand, but no more supply. What is that going to do? It's like basic intro econ. If supply stays the same and demand goes up a lot, especially for a product like this, that means the price is going to go up a lot and the amount produced will barely change. That's not a kind of a solution at all. It's a terrible idea. Another thing that people are really fond of is just public housing. It's public housing has a lot of problems. Start with the fact that almost all housing has been produced by the private sector already. Yeah, so we're talking 99% of all housing in America is already produced by the private sector. The private sector is the place that builds homes successfully. Government is just a rounding error. And when you look at what they're building, it's a good thing too, because quality is low, cost is high. There's just so much resentment of this industry where they provide this very useful good of housing.
What do you think of the work? I'm not sure how familiar you are with Gorlin Architects, the work of Alexander Gorlin in providing affordable housing in New York City.
Right. I mean, usually this phrase affordable means the government is doing it. And I just think that is not a very good approach. It's a lot better just to unleash the market, deregulate so that we can have a lot of cheap housing available to everyone. Affordable housing usually means...
But some people might say, Brian, it's not a lot of affordable housing. It's a lot of expensive housing.
Right. Well, here's the thing. So poor people live all over the United States. Right. And normally they are living in housing that was built by the private sector, usually some time ago. Right now, as to what's the effect of allowing the building of new housing on them? People often think, well, if the poor aren't going to live in the new housing, then it doesn't help them. And again, this is basic economics, totally wrong, because when you build new expensive luxury housing, who moves there? Well, people who are living in housing that isn't quite as nice are likely to move there. Who moves to the housing that they left? People living in housing that wasn't as nice as that. It's all connected. You can just see this, that poor people are usually living in older homes. If you're living in a 20-year-old place that isn't very expensive, it's only there because 20 years ago, someone was allowed to build something nice and then it deteriorates over time. It really is actually the normal way that people with low income get a decent place is just by letting people build stuff.
I don't want to turn this into a Trump conversation. I'm guessing you're probably not a great fan, but of course he's America's most famous developer of real estate. Are there enough Trumps? Are the entrepreneurs these days, the smart young kids who want to make a lot of money, Are they going into building or are they going into digital infrastructure?
So, well, you know, here's what I can tell you. The construction industry employs about 10 million people right now. It's a major industry. There's a ton of smart people there. It's probably not one where the typical kid from Stanford is thinking that I'll go into it, but there's a lot of smart people in the industry. It's, you know, it's usually like the industries that are cool are ones that are new, but it doesn't mean that there isn't a lot of talent that exists there.
But also ones you can make a lot of money on that. Yeah. So yes. To use a Bay Area term, that scale. So you can become a multi-millionaire or a billionaire.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of really rich real estate developers too. I mean, right now, honestly, a big part of their scale is just knowing the politicians that will get them the permissions.
Well, how do you become, we know in the Bay Area about becoming a startup tech person. Is it easy to become a startup to developer if you're somebody who says, well, I'd like to get into that business. I'd like to build a few houses here and I need to raise capital. Is that easy?
Right. So in your very regulated places, no, because to just be able to navigate the system, you need to have a lot of experience and personal connections to know, like, who are all the people I have to talk to in order to get all the different permissions? Who are the groups that are going to oppose me, and how can I get them at least to calm down a bit? I think that is a problem. It is worth pointing out that it's never actually easy to start your own business. You can say it's easy to do a startup. It's easy to say, I'm a startup now. To actually be successful, there are thousands of failed startups or a successful one.
Yeah, you know,
your usual route is, you know, you start off working in the industry and learning the ropes and how it's done and making some connections. And then once you actually know a way of doing it well or better, then that's where you branch out. That's what
I am a serially failed digital entrepreneur, which is why I'm wasting my time with this podcast, Brian. Mm-hmm. What about corruption? I'm guessing, and again, this is a softball for you, that the more housing regulation you have, the more corruption there is, the more politicians on the take, the more backdoor deals, which doesn't really benefit anyone except perhaps local bureaucrats, politicians, and the developer.
Yeah, it seems very likely there's a lot. It's the kind of thing that doesn't get studied by researchers that much because you could really only go and study the discovered corruption, which then is like, well, right.
You end up in the bottom of the East River if you study too much.
Right. I'd say that, again, the main issue is not so much the corruption as just the puritanical nature of the regulators who won't make exceptions for anything for any reason. You know, a lot of the reason why any building is happening is that there is at least political wheeling and dealing. Probably most of it isn't even illegal. It's just, well, it's kind of cheesy, but it's like, that's the way the game is played. The best evidence I know of on this, there's a cool book called Neighborhood Defenders, where the authors got transcripts from most of the land use meetings in Massachusetts, and they just went through the transcripts. Like, what are people even saying at land use meetings? What's striking about the book is most of the complaints are real petty. They're almost never talking about, I don't want my property values coming down, or it's going to go and cost me. It's more of like, I have a really nice view. I don't want it tampered with for any price. There's a bird nest. You know, there are things where it's like you've got some really tiny complaint and billions of dollars on the line, and yet the system listens to the two people with petty complaints and treats them like they're really important. I think the fundamental problem is just lack of thinking in terms of numbers and saying, all right, yeah, you've got 10 complaints, but they're like million-dollar complaints. This is a billion-dollar skyscraper, so let's just go full speed ahead and let's not take the complaints that seriously. It's really hard for a democracy to say, tough luck, we're not going to worry about your stupid complaints.
But not a softball, Brian, and then we got to end.
We need a lot more of this.
I'm assuming you're not a big fan of rent control either. It seems to have had a particularly problematic impact on real estate development and indeed the buying and selling of homes in the Bay Area and indeed in Manhattan. What's your take on rent control?
Yeah. I mean, compared to going and saying you can't build a skyscraper because a bird's nest will be moved, rent control's reasonable. But yeah, there's a basic economic critique to rent control, which is it goes and makes it cheaper for people while not only not making any extra supply, but by discouraging supply. I could go and rent out some places here, but why bother? Why not just go and sit on them? Well, so yeah, that's the classic complaint about rent control. I was in Berkeley during the era of very strict rent control. I mean, like, it's very basic economics. It's not ideological. You can go and talk to very democratic economists and they'll tell you the same thing I'm going to tell you, which is when you've got rent control that actually pushes prices down, it means people want a lot more. They want to buy a lot more, but they want to sell a lot less, which means that there is a queue, a line. It's hard to actually get what you want. And then some lucky people who happen to have been living there get a bonanza, and everybody else sits around hoping to get lucky. Come on, come on, come on. Hopefully I'll be the first person who shows up here. And even that is optimistic because a standard response of landlords to rent control is just to start cutting quality, not do maintenance, not worry about it, be indifferent to complaints. Then the usual rent control response is to go and have a giant list of all the things you have to do. But if the courts get full enough, then the fact that in principle you're breaking the law doesn't matter all that much.
Yeah, and of course, all these stories of wealthy people in the Bay Area and in Manhattan having rent control.
Right, but can you even blame the landlord? It's like if you have invested your life savings in a building and then you are told you have to go and sell it for half the market price and you're losing money on it. It's like that point, do you really want to keep going and making sure that the air conditioning works? It's one where I would blame the people who passed the laws and say, look, the people that are responding in this way, like what they're doing is the way that a normal person would respond given this crummy situation.
Finally, Brian, we've got to end now, an interesting conversation. Do you think you're really arguing for a return to pre-New Deal America, back to 19th century, I wouldn't say morality, 19th century spirit of just getting things done and not endlessly worrying about local regulation? Is it a return to what America once stood for?
Well, here's what I'll say. I don't like to try to convince people about any bigger issue than what I'm talking about. Like this, what I'm saying about housing is controversial enough. I don't need to sell anybody on a big philosophy. When I do ethics, what I do is look, here's a bunch of different ethical points of view and they all end up at the same conclusion. So personally, I would say, we had a much better system for housing before 1920 where it was possible to build almost anything. If you just look at all the buildings that were built in the main cities that just couldn't be built today, but also just to see how people in the past were able to produce housing much more cheaply by going and making very sensible compromises, like you don't need an acre of land. Now it's very common in my area to say you have to have a full acre of land in order to put a house. In the past, you would go and squeeze 5 houses onto that area, which meant that there would be 4 extra families that could have a house there. It's just a very much more pragmatic and reasonable approach. So you don't need to agree with any general philosophy to agree with me on this stuff. I wrote the whole book precisely to say, I think almost any reasonable person, no matter what your philosophy, if you look at the facts, will come away agreeing with me. So that's the